Testing, 1, 2.
But anyway, it's my great pleasure to introduce you to my friend Rayanne.
And per your too.
And per your too. You're absolutely right.
Hey, I'm Rayanne, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Bill, for asking me.
I'll move it.
Yeah. So I'm sitting here, and like, there's too many devices here, and I like tech, but all of a sudden I got really nervous. I'm just like zoning in over there. Welcome to the newcomers and our visitor. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This place, these rooms, these steps have saved my life and countless others. And I have so much gratitude for this program. I don't like to say that I'm a miracle. I'm just not there. But I belong to a miracle part. I'm part of a miracle. And, you know, my sobriety date is June 6th, 1994. I'm transposing numbers now. You know, that was the day that I had to come clean with everything. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes. But I was born and raised in Fresno, and I have two older brothers that were partying, and they paved the way for me, so they say. My dad was an alcoholic, and my mom, I'm not sure if she was an alcoholic. I know she was totally codependent, but not sure if she was just went through a heavy drinking period. But regardless, I come from an alcoholic dysfunctional family, but you would never have known it on the outside. But on the inside, we were all dying, and it was just crazy. I just want to say that I'm not going to go through a big drunk log, but I will say that growing up, I always felt different. I didn't know what that different was. I just didn't feel like I was a part of, and I had a lot of friends, but I just felt like for some reason they were talking about me or they were just being nice. I just always had this excuse because I just didn't feel like I fit in. And there was chaos going on in my family, and I couldn't quiet that down. And then, you know, something was wrong with me because I just didn't feel like I belonged. And I did everything I could to fit in. And, you know, and I don't even know if that's why I drink, but I know when I drank, all of that went away. It felt really good. I loved beer. My friends had to acquire a taste, and I didn't. I loved it from the get-go. And I drank like a pig from the get-go. I was 12, and my friends, we would go and pimp beer. And if you don't know what that is, that's when you go stand in front of a liquor store and get someone older to buy for you, and you throw in, you know, back then it was like you bought them a 12-pack or something. I don't know what it is today. I don't even know people do that. But that's how we got, or older brothers and sisters would help us out. And, you know, I wanted my own 12-pack. And my four friends, they could have their own because I drank fast, and I couldn't stop drinking. And that is, when I put alcohol in me, I can't stop. And I would either pass out, which I used to call falling asleep, or most of the time I blacked out because I couldn't stop. I didn't know where that line is, and forever trying to find where that feeling good, this feels great. And next thing I know, I'm waking up the next morning and I've got, you know, rock pebbles stuck in my face from falling down, or I have new bruises, or in different cities. That's just the way it was. But when I put alcohol in me, you know, I was taller, I was blonde, I could be anything you wanted me to be, you know, but I was never Rayanne, because you wouldn't like Rayanne. You know, if you knew what was going on inside me and the things that I was doing, you wouldn't like me. So I pretended I was somebody else all the time. Fast forward, you know, like I said, some of my drinking, you know, escapades aren't that great. I'm kind of boring, actually. But one that really was kind of fun is that I joined a sorority. And that's, there's another thing. I joined a sorority thinking, okay, these 40 women, I'm going to be friends with at least one of them, right? I get in there, and it's going along, pretty good for a while, and all of a sudden that same feeling, I don't belong. This is different. So what do? I go and party with the fraternities. And so one of the fraternities was having a contest of how many beer shots you can drink in an hour. So we went out, and the girls, and you got pledges. So, how many can you drink? I said, I don't know. So I had, people doing 5 cents, 25 cents, a dollar. And so that night, I was the first one there. It was in a rectangle, and the keg was catty-corner from me, and we had these pitchers of beer, and they said, go. So I was pouring my little... And I'm like, So I just started dunking it in the pitcher, drinking it. And then I remember losing the cake. And I came to a couple of times, but I drank 121 shots in an hour up here. And I look back now and think, I could have died. I could have had alcohol poisoning. That was a lot of alcohol in a short amount of time. And I'm only 5 foot. I haven't grown since 8th grade. So, I like that. I was getting the attention, And I was so ashamed, though. I didn't want, the people that were giving me a dollar. I couldn't go to them and say, hey, you owe me $120. So I just kind of hid out for a while. I had like a 2-day hangover. It was terrible. I might also want to add that, when I drank, and it didn't matter what I drank, but when I did drink, I couldn't throw up. I just don't have that reflex to throw up. So I have the worst hangovers. Because everybody said, you throw up and you feel good and keep drinking. Well, I just kept drinking until I passed out. So that's the kind of drink where I was, get the attention. Give me that vodka bottle. I'll drink it. And that was all, fun drinking until it came to a point, I had married someone from Corcoran, so I moved from Fresno to Corcoran. And one more time, I'm going to have all these new friends in this town, right? No, it didn't take long before I got back into that thinking of, these are all David's friends. They have to be nice to me. I got this job because of him, blah, 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 blah. All these excuses just so that I could feel different, I did a lot of drinking in that time. At one time, they had 4 pizza parlors, and I did a lot of drinking in those, in particular one pizza parlor. And my last drunk there, I never want to forget that. I was... I went down to, we used to play volleyball, rec the Y, and afterwards we would go to a pizza parlor, and we would sit down at this table, and there was probably, 15, 20 people there when I started, and I had my son with me, and I told my husband, I'm going down for 2 beers. These guys were all playing volleyball. I wasn't playing anymore. I was, I was just there for the drinking. And we started playing the dollars game where you lie at how many 7s there are or 1s, and I was sitting there just drinking a beer or 2, and the next thing I know is I looked over, and I saw my son. He was 3 at the time, and he was making pizza boxes with the owner. I thought, okay, he's taken care of. I'm good. So I went back to drinking, and then I came to again, and everybody was gone except across from me, and that was the G-Town drunks, and I just felt horrible. It's like, this is what life has become. And granted, 8 years before I got sober, my dad and brother had gotten sober, and I used to sit in meetings in Fresno listening to stories, and I could identify with the drinking and the feelings, but as soon as they start talking about recovery and stopping drinking and steps and all that, I just turned off. There's no way. I can't do that. That's not me. And I wasn't ready, until 8 years later. But that night, something happened, and I knew the next day I was going, next year, the day after that, I was going down to this eating disorder hospital. Because everybody knew that I had an eating disorder. It was obvious. But anyways, at that, I wanted to make sure I said, that night, I don't remember getting home. I woke up the next morning early, shaking, because I was starting to get the DTs, because I was drinking almost every night. Getting the DTs, and I was shaking, and I ran into my son's room, and he was there, and I ran outside, and the car was parked good, no scratches or anything. And I don't know how I drove. My husband came and got me. If someone drove me, I had no idea. And all of a sudden, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. And I knew from sitting in those meetings years before that if I wanted a chance at life, I had to come clean with everything. And at this point, I just wanted to die. I was praying that I wouldn't wake up anymore, you know, because I couldn't do it. And every day I said, okay, I'm not going to drink today. And, you know, right after school, I'd start drinking. And or I was miserable, or I was thinking about how I was going to, when I was going to be drinking and where my kids were going to go, what babysitter haven't I used this time? And it took a lot of work. But I was done. I was so tired, and I knew deep down I was done with this behavior. And I went down to that eating disorder hospital as an anorexic bulimic, and I came out an alcoholic. And I was working a couple programs when I got back. And they kicked me out after 2 weeks. The insurance did, because they said I wasn't that bad. Well, I didn't, they, you know, wanted to know if you ever tried to commit suicide. I didn't want to tell them, because I did. I was afraid if I told them the story, they were going to put a straitjacket on me and take me away. You know, I watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest went to the Giants, and I thought, that's me. They're going to take me. So I lied about it, or I just didn't tell them. And so I was on my way after 2 weeks and scared, but knew what I needed to do. I had enough in there, and there was a lady in there. She was one of the nurses, and I told her, look, I'm really scared. Am I going to make it? And her story was a lot like mine, so she sat down with me for about an hour and, you know, tell me basically what I needed to do. So when I got out, I went to a Saturday night meeting in Tulare. The meeting's no longer there anymore. Sunday night, not Saturday night. And it was a candlelight meeting. And I met, you know, my first friends in AA. And one of them was David Looper. And he scared me because he had his big book and he was talking loud and... But, you know, I got to know him, and, you know, may he rest in peace. But, you know, I know I needed to get a sponsor, so I was going to all these meetings, and, you know, they said, you know, you need to find someone that you want what they have. Well, I kind of didn't really hear that, so I said, okay, I just want what this person has. So, you know, I got this lady, and I don't know, things were going, I guess they were going okay, but after a couple of weeks, my dad says, hey, you know, how's your sponsor doing? And I said, oh, fine. I go, but she hasn't called me, and because she's not going to either, stupid. I go, oh, I didn't get it. I didn't know, you know, what was going on, because I was like going to the meetings, but I was just sitting there, like, listening, and so my dad suggested this lady who, happened to be related to my mom's side of the family. So I got this lady, and I have her still today. And jokingly, my dad and brother, and people used to call her the step-Nazi with combat boots. But that's exactly what I needed. And this lady is, you know, absolutely amazing, and she will remind me that... she's not God, and that I have one. But I owe her, because she saw right through me. She knew, and in fact, the first time I met with her, she lived in Helm, so she lived about an hour away from me. And so I drove out to Helm, and she asked me to open my big book, and she says, what's there? And I said, nothing. And she goes, absolutely, you know nothing. I'm like, oh, this lady really needs something, right? And she's kind of scared me, and I mean, she still scares me today when she said that. But you know, she's no nonsense, and she loved me until I could love myself. It was God. It really was God, because I didn't trust anybody, but I started trusting her, and that came fast. And I just knew. I mean, there was an incident with our family where they tried to call her to tell her, a conference call with my parents, tell her how I really was, and she very politely said, I'm going to hang up, and I will be telling Rayanne about this, and she told me. So I knew that, you know, I could trust this lady, and so she She had me start from the beginning, step one, and I worked through the steps, and I read that big book. Those steps were outlined in the big book, and that's how I read them. That's how I worked the steps. And that's how I sponsor people, is through that big book. I was, an overachiever, so I was going to do those steps in 30 days, because, didn't you know, look at me. And that didn't happen. And everything that I thought to be true was wrong and false, and everything that I couldn't ever imagine to be true came true. And it was just the opposites. But I had to be willing, honest, and open. And I was. And there was something inside of me that said, you need to come clean with everything. So I was working these three programs. I qualify for more. And I just couldn't do it. But I knew there was something I knew about. AA was my foundation. So I stuck with AA, went to meetings 3 or 4 times a week. I drove from Corcoran for 25 years, 3 to 4 times a week. My first 2 years of sobriety, I drove every Friday night to Fresno, because that's where my dad and brother got sober at the Village Group. So I knew those people, and they were happy, and I trusted them, So I would go there, and then one of the gentlemen says, you need to quit piggyback riding for your dad, and you need to find your own groups. And so, I was going to meetings in Westside, but I knew what that meant. And today, I have a home group. I have the same sponsor. I work the steps. After we did the steps, which just like everybody else, when I'm writing my 4-step, there was some stuff I am not going to tell for anybody about. I'm going to my grave with it. That wasn't the case. I was willing and I was open, and she shared a little bit of her fit with me, and it's like, oh, okay, I can do this. And she asked me what the worst thing on my list was, and I told her, and from that it was pretty, pretty easy. And then it was like a weight had been lifted. And that doesn't mean since that point, life has just been wonderful. No, it hasn't. But after the steps, I had to go make, through the steps, making amends, right? And I thought, oh my goodness, there's just no way I'm going to make amends to such and such and such and such. And the big book even says that. So she asked me if I would be willing to do it. And I can do that. After a few years, the opportunity arose, and I had to do some work on this. And I had a high school boyfriend that it was not a good, it was a very abusive relationship. And years had passed, and I was sitting at my dad's office in Fresno, and here he comes walking in with somebody else, and I hated this SOB. I wanted him dead. And I called my sponsor on the phone. I said, he's here, he's here. And she's like, who's here? She didn't know what I was talking about. And I, said his name, and so she goes, well, go somewhere where you're okay. I said, I am. I'm sitting in my dad's office in his chair, and she goes, are you going to be okay? I'll talk to you. I said, you know what? I'm going to go make my amends. Don't know what came over me. That tool got things. So I got up, I went out and started talking to him, and basically, I made my amends to him, and he jokingly, I started it off because he said something like, hey, so if we were still dating today, where do you think we'd be? And I said, I'd be dead. And he goes, you're right. Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of led right into it. And today I have absolutely no hate for this person at all. And that was probably one of the hardest ones that I was going to do, because I didn't feel like I owed him anything, but I found my part. And today a couple weeks ago, his mom called me. It was in a very, very bad accident, and has brain injuries, severe brain injuries, and I was able to be there for her and send my love to him. And that's what this program does, for us. And I have nothing but love for him. After working the steps, my sponsor had me read the traditions and go over those with me. She says, those are just as important. The steps are for you and the traditions are for the group. So you don't go in there and act like you're queen and you're going to run the show. I mean, she knew me. And so that's learning the traditions was awesome. And I still go, for most of my sobriety, I've always tried to go to a big book meeting, a traditions meeting. I just feel like I need to, there's more I need to learn because I don't understand a lot of it. And I want to hear other people's, you know, I guess we could say perception of what they say. And then I get more confused, so I have to keep going. I moved to Visalia 2 years ago, and I absolutely love it. I love being closer to meetings, first of all. Now I don't have to drive 30, 40 minutes, and I can go more often. And I've gotten into more service work. I used to do, service work like when I first got sober, and it was secretary this meeting, greeter, those kind of things, give someone a ride to a meeting. At 7 or 8 years sober, my sponsor told me it was time to give back to my community, which was important. And so I went and helped out the AA meetings there. And it was me and another gentleman, and for 7 years, he was the secretary and I was the treasurer. And we had a lot of people come in and out, in and out, in and out. And I was going probably to one or two meetings a week over here. I just, I also, my kids were at an age I wanted to be with them. They were playing sports, and my son was a drummer, so I wanted to be there for my kids and not be like my parents. Well, that's not true. My mom was always there. My dad wasn't. But I wanted to be that person, so it was important to me, so I did meetings in Corcoran. Because of that, I was able to help start a Spanish-speaking AA meeting and an NA meeting. And unfortunately, today, the meetings aren't there anymore. The gentleman that was the secretary, and he must have been secretary for 15 years, he passed away about 6 years ago, and tragically. And so, unfortunately, no one's really picked it up again. So keep praying for them, though. Other service work, I was a GSR. I've been a CSR. Because I heard if you get into service, chances are you'll stay sober. So I like those chances, so I did it. And I continue to be in service. And that's, can really be like sponsoring people, but I'm so close now I can do things that I ordinarily wasn't able to do living so far away. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can never get back what it's given me. And my life today is not perfect. I have problems, and I pay bills and everything like that, but it's nothing that I imagined. And I'm retired, and I worked, I taught kids for 30 years, and I love kids. So, I got involved with an organization here in town that deals with kids. I'm just kind of a big kid. so the service work doesn't always have to be just in Alcoholics Anonymous. It can be, it's service to, the community too. Well, I'm a productive part of society, where before I wasn't. And I had a lot of yes. I didn't have, I didn't get a drunk driving. I was pulled over, got out of it. I didn't go to jail. I didn't do this, I didn't that. And the reason why I didn't go to jail, I didn't get caught. I drove drunk. I drove drunk with my friends. I drove drunk with my kids. I just never got caught. And I heard in these rooms that, one of the worst things for an alcoholic is not having enough alcohol. And two, getting caught, getting away with something, not getting caught, getting away with something. And I believe that to be true. A little bit about, I'm going to backtrack a little bit about my family. My grandmother died, oh Lord, it's probably been close to 20 years, and I'm very, very close to my grandmother. And when I have trouble praying to God, I pray to my grandmother, because she was a very religious woman, but she was also very spiritual. And I didn't even see it until years later. So I'll pray to her because I know she always listened to me. I knew that was the one person really in my life that I knew unconditionally loved me was my grandma, my dad's mom. And so that death was kind of hard. She had cancer, and I was able to be there. We had some days at school where we could earn extra money, and I didn't go. I went to the rest home my grandmother was in, and I played bingo with her friends. And at the end, you know, when she was on that hospital, I crawled up in bed with her and just held her. And it was beautiful. Then about 11 years ago, 11 and a half years ago, my mom, well, through a series of events, she broke her hip, and anyway, she ended up in the hospital, and she had lupus, and it was the end of her life, let's just say that. And I took off work, and for a week, I stayed with her. Every night, again, crawled up in bed with her and held her and told her that I loved her and, you know, and just talked to her. And, you know, her sister, we were there the whole time. And, you know, it's hard to go through death, but I'll tell you what, being there for my mom was incredible. It's hard to explain because I didn't get along with my mom up until about 3 or 4 years before she died. I just couldn't stand her. I thought my dad's problems were because of her, and she picked on me and she was critical, blah 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 blah, right? And it wasn't until, it's sad, you know, it wasn't until about 3 years before she died that I really understood acceptance, and I accepted her for exactly who she was. And I put aside all my crap and just loved her. And so that last week, it was just, it was incredible. I was able to be there. I was present. And that, being present for someone is amazing. I can never do that. And I'm still working on it. It's hard. And then 6 years ago, what's today? Sunday. 6 years ago, Friday, my dad was found dead in his bed. He had overdosed on alcohol and some pills. He had about 15 years sobriety and went out. He started trying to get sober in 1960 and just could never get it, in and out, in and out, in and out. And this last time, he just couldn't do it. And, you know, I told him about a year before he died, I just said, you know, Dad, you're going to do what you want to do, but no matter what, I love you, and I will always be your daughter, and I'm here for you, but I just can't watch you do this. And almost a year to the day, he died. They found him. And then a year and a half, 2 years in January, same thing, my brother overdosed. He had 19 years of sobriety. And, you know, he went back out, and he couldn't get back, and he kept telling me, I'm going to go to meetings, and I told him, Mark, it's not the meetings, it's the steps. That's where you find your peace and your serenity, or in those steps. I'm going to go, and he never made it back. And, you know, those two people dying is such a great lesson for me. I don't want to be a statistic like them. You know, one of three of us is still here. You know, I don't know what would happen. Yeah, I do know what would happen if I'd go out. I'd get drunk. But I don't know if I could ever make it back. And the statistics like that, I don't want to take them. I love what I have here. You know, even on my worst day, you know, it's just not worth it. And I wanted to also you'll have to stop me. I get my thing off. Wow, there's like a lot I could say. You know, I know as to see prayer. I went to Catholic schools for 12 years, and I know every rote prayer there is. But about 9 months sober, 6 months sober, I asked my sponsor, "How do you pray?" No, I was clueless. Me praying was like praying to Santa Claus, you know, and then why didn't you give me this? Or, oh God, please get me out of this. I'll be good. You know, that was my kind of praying. I was very selfish and self-centered. And so when I had to learn really how to pray, because I didn't think I was doing it right, I asked her, and then I went on a retreat with a member. She's since passed away, Sue Noonan. And she goes, come on, come with me. We're going to go to this retreat. And it was all about prayer and meditation. And I learned how to pray, and it was praying for others. You know, I didn't hear that when I was growing up. I mean, maybe for others, you know. And if I want to pray for myself, you know, if it's God's will, you know, thy will be done, not mine. And I find my prayers today are a lot of thank yous. A lot of thank yous. Thank you for another day of sobriety. Thank you for this. Thank you for that. Because God has given me so much. And, you know, those kids that were 1 in 3 when I got sober are 28 and 30. And they're both successful, doing well. That husband that I married 32 years ago, the one that I actually was going to divorce every other day in the first 5 years of marriage, you know, he trusts me. He loves me. I love him. We're friends, too. We have a lot of fun together. That's not how I was raised. You know, my mom and dad, you know, fought a lot. You got Italian and Mexican. Oh, and throw a little Basque in there, too. You know, whoever shouted the loudest was the one that was heard, you know. But I also, you know, lately, I mean, it's the 11th month, so that's usually step 11, where prayer and meditation and gratitude focus on. But this time around, it hit me a couple weeks ago about being present, truly being present in everything. And, you know, and I catch myself, because sometimes I'll be on the phone and I'm washing dishes or I'm folding clothes. That's not being present. I used to think multitasking was like, ooh, I'm good at multitasking. No, today I just want to do one thing, and being present for that person when they're on the phone, Zooming, or, you know, in person, whatever I'm doing, taking somewhere. And I really work hard on that. And then last, I heard a sponsee say, excuse me, she spoke at a meeting a couple weeks ago in Fresno, and she talked about what's her purpose in life, basically. And I always thought, for me, the goal of sobriety was, well, to be sober, but to be happy, joyous, and free. That's what I thought this was all about, right? And it dawned on me when she said something, that's not it, you know. It's to be of maximum service to my higher power and for others. And when I am in service, like I am tonight, you know, that's what brings me joy. You know, working with those little kids I have, that's what brings me joy. That's what makes me happy. It's not, and I don't do it to be happy. It just happens. It's like, oh, maybe that's the point. So I know, you know, I don't have all the answers. Just ask my sponsors. They'll tell you. I don't know. You know, but today I know I'm a better listener. I don't end up in jail. I don't have hangovers. I don't steal from people. You know, those things that I used to do. And I have a pretty good life today. And like I said, you know, stuff happens. And I don't have to drink over it. I didn't have to drink over those deaths, you know, or use or do anything mind altering, because that's what I wanted. I don't want to feel. And I'll do anything so I don't feel. But it's the easier, softer way is just to work the program. And working the program for me is going to meetings, reading the big book, talking to my sponsor. I still talk to her once a week, every week, whether I'm in town or not, doesn't matter. I think in 27 years, I've missed like 3 times, 4 times. And I called her and I said, oh, I can't believe I forgot. There was a time, it was about a year and a half after her husband passed away, which was my mom's cousin, that I did have to get another sponsor for a while. And I still call her every Sunday, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, I might have to or something. And so I got her back. after things kind of just got settled in a new place. But, you know, I don't know what more I could say except, you know, be of service and, you know, give this program a chance. You know, don't leave before the miracle happens. Thanks.
All right.
Can you take the picture off me now? Yeah. I'm going to do that. Hey, everybody. So we're now going to start the discussion part of the meeting. We'd like to hear from as many different people as possible. So we ask you to keep that in mind when you're sharing. Make sure we leave time for everyone to participate. And with that, I'm going to hand the controls back to my dear friend. And she can... pick on people to share. There's also a list of people online here. So
where I don't see where they
are. So you can.
Okay, here we go. Thank you.
We're ready for you.
Okay. Well, Erica just went to the restroom. So I, Mike K.
Mike, do you have a microphone? There we go.
Yeah, I'm on my laptop. Hi, everybody. Hi, Rand. It was great hearing from you. I'm Mike, alcoholic. I haven't seen you for a while. COVID has kept me out of meetings and stuff like that. You had a very, very wonderful share, and I hope the newcomers listened to what you had to say because it was very, very positive, you know, and that's one of the things that I've always enjoyed hearing from you. I remember seeing you come in, and... you know, I had a few years sobriety already, and it was great seeing you, and it's still great seeing you. I remember when I used to drive out to Corcoran, I used to drive in front of your house and wave hi to you, you know, when you lived out in Corcoran, you know, and I'm just grateful to be here, and when Bill said that you were sharing, I got excited because I haven't seen you in a while, and I really appreciate your message, and I hope newcomers appreciate your message. And thanks for letting me be here, and thanks for letting me record you. I'm going to put you on my website, and you have a great one. It's good seeing you.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Erica. Thanks for sharing. My name's Erica. I'm not called.
Hey, Erica.
I can relate to a lot of what you said. Not liking to feel feelings. And it's the holidays right now, which is rough. I get super emotional around the holidays. And I'm super pregnant. So it's a little bit of emotion. You know, to have just old hurt with my family members when I was using and drinking, and now in sobriety, you know, it kind of just makes you realize that not everything is perfect when you get sober, but the thing is that you don't have to numb the pain. It's almost more gratifying for me to feel it and come out on the other side. And so what I ended up doing was kind of like getting into the book and reading a little bit of the agnostics, and it kind of, you know, enlightens me in a big way. Just reading about lack of power, which is what I'm feeling right now, lack of power. You know, in my old ways, in my addiction and my drinking would be to try to manipulate situations, to try to punish people, to get the result that I wanted. And, you know, that was my power. And so, you know, gaining some spiritual principles, walking through a different way of life, I have to turn to my higher power to gain power. So what I realize is that I am powerless. And, you know, the way I used to act and the way I used to treat people, it never helped. And it just caused a lot of frustration, which would lead to more drinking, more using, and just, you know, a dismal way of life that I get to enjoy. So, that's where I'm at.
Good to see you, Erica.
David.
David Alcoholics.
Hi, David.
Thank you for your share, Ann. Every time I hear you share, I look forward to it because I know you have a high quality share. And again, it was great. There's so many things that I can identify with in your share. Starting from the beginning, right? I felt like that outsider. Now I have come to learn that I was that outsider. But it didn't change the fact that I felt it, and there's I used alcohol to cope. There's a lot of me share that I really like. To kind of paraphrase something that we didn't say it, but I heard it, interpreted it. And today I get to do things, right? I get to do laundry. I get to go to work. I get to pay bills. The alternative was not good, right? I was profoundly unable to get myself out of the situation I got myself into, and these groups saved my life. And so I heard in your share all the things that I needed, the kind of thing I needed to hear on my first meeting, right? And it's been great. It has. For the last 2.5, 3 years, I've been waking up happy. never used to have. So, there's a lot in your share that I really like. But that's not about me. Leave it out, follow up.
Thanks, David.
Hi, everybody. My name is Matt, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. Thanks for being here tonight. Rayanne, I think you and I have known each other about 14 years, and I've known you to be just a real steady member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I were asked to point to someone I know has a comprehensive, well-grounded, well-founded program in AA and stable security and can answer questions, I would point to you. A few others, but I would point to you, and I admire you and your straightforward honesty about your story, and I'm sorry for the deaths in your family. When you were sharing about your family, I kind of got reflective about mine, and one of the great things that the program teaches me is that gratitude, and I'm grateful for the program. I'm grateful for my relationship with my higher power. And I don't want to minimize it. I'm grateful for all that stuff. At this time in the holidays, I reflect on my family, and we're looking forward to getting together. And one thing that strikes me that I'm very grateful for is that of my entire family, I am the only living alcoholic that's in treatment. Nobody else in my family at this time is either afflicted or blessed with this, whichever way you want to look at it. But I'm the only one that faces the things that this dysphoric brain faces, and I thank my higher power, and that one is God, that the rest of my family is normal, and I think I'm gonna pull up there. Thanks for your share. Thanks for being on the air tonight. And thank you, everybody there. Thanks. My name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic.
Thanks, Matt. Okay, Joe.
Oh, my name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hey, Joe.
Second time they call me. My beginning starts when I came to the United States at the age of six. My mom married a white man, Cody, a German. You know, and I tell these guys that every morning we had to, no, I'm just kidding. But anyway, it started there, and what happened was during that time, things were okay. You know, I'm a kid. You know, I didn't know any different. You know, about prejudice, verbal abuse. Didn't know none of that stuff. You know, I just wanted to have fun. You know, kids should have fun. You know, I didn't know any English, but I made it through. You know, and stuff like that. And then my mom gave my stepdad two sons. The next youngest was 7, and then the other one, 9 years behind me. So there's a big spread. And then my older brother is 4 years older than me. So we had a big gap. I didn't get to grow up with brothers or sisters because the gap was too different, too far apart. So as time went on, I started noticing, and there was a lot of pain, resentment, even though I did not know that's what I was feeling. Because, you know, at Christmas, they would get the big gifts, and we would get the little gifts, you know. It seemed like there was something wrong with this picture. But, you know, it was better than Mexico. You know what I'm saying? So it was no biggie, you know. I learned to accept that. But as time got, you know, I grew older and older, something wasn't right. You know, there was no communication. There was no feeling of love. My mom didn't care if I was out on the streets, in a sense. I had to be home at a certain time, yes. But I could go out there and just wander around. And I did that. And I started experimenting with a lot of stuff. Not alcohol or drugs at that time. But like maybe taking, does anybody remember G.I. Joe? I used to go to the store and just look at the stuff and I loved it, you know? So I started stealing. Because I never liked that stuff, you know? And I was envious, I guess that's where, at my brothers that did get it. Mm-hmm. And then I started stealing, I found an old BB gun, the old the old BB guns, you know? Don't issue like for hair to bear, you know. But anyway, yeah. And I used to go steal BBs, you know. And that wasn't me. I wasn't brought up that way, you know. But I started doing that because there was no attention, no nothing. I even burned a brush once just for the hell of it, you know. I kind of looked in for that. You know, they found out who it was. And I got hit pretty good there, you know. But my mom did all the discipline. My stepdad never touched us. But that man was very, very abusive in his language and the way he treated us. He treated us like a piece of, you know what I'm saying. And I was in top tools to let go, you know. There was no communication, like love and stuff. They, you know, talk to you, you know. I learned it on my own. What can you learn? Not very much. I tried to do the best. I carried the name Koenig for 8 years, from 6 to about 14 or 15, no, about 15. And Koenig, I played baseball, football, and basketball, and I lettered in all three of them. But except that I never saw one game. Something's wrong with this picture. So one day I went to my mom and I said, "Hey mom," I says, "how come you never go to the game?" "Well, I really don't know, you gotta ask, you know. But you're my mom, you know, and she was afraid of him. Because he drank a little bit. Not a lot, but he drank. And she was fearful of him. And I remember that I went up to him and I asked him, "What, don't you love me? Or how come you don't go to my kids?" He goes, "Well, son," he did call me son. He goes, "You know, you're not really my son." What? I knew he wasn't. But the way he said it, it destroyed me. He says, and I said, what? You never adopted me? I'm hearing your name. You never adopted me? You never, you know, anything like that? He goes, no, and I won't. So I went to my mom. I said, Mom, I'm going to change my name to your name, you know, her name, which is Gonzalez. That's what I carry now. And I told my stepdad, he goes, okay, I don't care. Well, all this it all consolidated. And I did not know I was starting to put all the stuff like Santa's, where he carries the toy bag, you know. It just got heavier and heavier and heavier. So I started getting it. I left sports and got into a gang. San Bernardino. Now here I am, 16 years old, running the streets, hurting people, robbing and doing all this. Crazy. It's crazy. What makes a person do that kind of stuff? I mean, I might think I know the answer, but I don't. So, and that started, and then that's when I started doing drinking and smoking pot. 16 years old. I'm going to be 68 tomorrow. 68 from 16, I've been doing a lot of drinking and a lot of drugs. Off and on the drugs, did PCP, angel dust, acid, but that was just like in a certain period during the 50 days, you know? It was, you know, at that time I was like, 16, 17 when, you know, Woodstock and everything was going on, you know? You know, flower shower, if you're going to San Francisco, make sure you put a flower in your head, you know? That kind of stuff, you know? And I wasn't into that kind of environment, but the drugs were, you know, it relieved my pain and stuff. Now, this is the self-pity. This is reality for me at that time. And I did not know how to handle it. So, and then I moved to San Jose, left that gang, went to San Jose, because I had nowhere to go. My mom moved to San Diego, and I said, my mom, I ain't moving with you guys, you know, I can't afford my stepdad, you know. So they left me behind, and me and my brother, at the age of 16, he got me a job at some burger place in San Bernardino, and we both tried to make it. He got drafted in the Army, and I had nowhere else to go. So my sister was living in San Jose, and I called her, and I said, hey, sis, you know, I got no place to go. So she says, come on down. So I went over there. I finished high school. I can't believe that I did. But I joined another gang. And now the drugs really started coming in. It was crazy. It was an outlet for me. Was it really? I don't know what it was. So I'm going to skip that. And then, in order for me to get out of the gang, I was either going to get beat up pretty bad, get shot, stabbed. You can't leave them. You know, once you're in, you know, you got to go. But you have to get initiated. And the only other way you can get initiated, Anthony can tell you, there's only one way out. So I joined the Marine Corps. I did 4 years in the Marine Corps. Straightened my ass out for 4 years. I sent to South Carolina, and I was so happy. Got married. Been married for 4 or 6 years to the same woman. I did 30 years in construction. I've done everything right in the sense of material stuff. I'm retired. I have a good pension. My wife has a pension. I get Social Security. She gets Social Security. I got a little nest egg. I have my own home paid for. I have a swimming pool. I am not just your ordinary. You know, I'm not saying ordinary. Well, I'm not a big businessman or anything. I work very hard for, you know, I send my kids to universities. You know, I work in construction, asphalt, those roadways, hard work. Anytime there was a Saturday or Sunday, I would volunteer. You know why? Because I started picking up then. I was on that for 25 years. And the only way I could go through that, working Saturdays and Sundays and working any overtime that I would do, I paid off my house in 17 years. All that overtime, that extra money, my wife would make an extra payment. If you do that 3 or 4 times a year, in 17 years you can pay off your house. That's what I mean. No. That's not too bad, is it? It seems like my life was good. It wasn't good. Having to cure stuff was just like an extra, you know. It's now that I'm, after I retired, I got my first DUI. I had too much time on my hands. Had her quite a bit, and I stopped for a year. For me. But then again, a year went by. I proved myself that I could do this. Before I knew it, I had my second DUI. That went through. Then I got my third DUI within 10 years. That's where I'm at right now. And everything that I have seems like I'm giving it away. I'm already at $20,000, and I'm not trying to talk about money, you know, but I'm at $20,000 for this DUI, and I'm still looking at 4 months in jail, you know. And my wife had surgery 6 years ago, brain surgery, so she's disabled on her right side. She can walk, but she needs a cane, and she has no really, her nerves aren't. You can poke her with a needle and she can't feel it. But she can walk. She's got the major nerves that make her legs bend and stuff, but I have to rub her down all the time. She's at home in Gilbert right now without her name. I'm over here trying to get help for myself, which is the right thing to do. Don't get me wrong. But why couldn't I have seen this before? 46 years of love. She gave me 2 kids. I got 6 grandkids. What am I showing them who I am? I don't even know who I am. I wake up and I cry sometimes. And a man ain't supposed to cry, but this man does. What the hell am I doing? You know what? It's so disturbing right now that my emotions get so... I'm on depression pills. Difficult Zola, because you know what? I created this little world of life, and I just don't know how to get out of it. And so now that I came all the way from your world over here to get away from that atmosphere, just break the cycle there and learn some tools and start reading the book and go to AA meetings. And right now I'm working on my higher power right now, even though, you know, I've been here just barely, I'm going on my 3rd week here. So I'm a newbie in the sense of that. But I've been around the block a long time, and I haven't learned nothing. It's time for me to learn something.
Right on, Joe.
And I just hope that through my fellowship here and finding a sponsor when I get back to the ORA, that this is going to work out. I have to have a purpose in life. I don't like me, but I want to, and I know that it's going to happen. I know it's going to happen. I have faith, hope, name it. I'm begging. I'm asking the higher power for his will to come upon me. Anyway, I'm Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you.
Hey everybody, I'm an alcoholic and I still have some. You know, I was thinking about when Graham was talking about that she had been sent to treatment for it was an eating disorder, I think you said, right? And she came out as an alcoholic, and I went to treatment. I had one of them surprise parties. I don't know about you guys, man. I always dreamed of having a surprise party, man. I wanted, oh my God, I wanted to come home one day from school and like all my friends be there and their be a pony and a bounce house and all that stuff. Actually, bounce houses didn't exist back then, right? But anyway, you get the idea. And I finally got my surprise party, but it was an intervention. And man, you know, it's kind of crazy. I kind of relate a lot, Joe. You were talking about, like, you know, some experiences and how maybe they didn't turn out the way you thought they were going to turn out, I had a tremendous amount of resistance to the help that my family was trying to get. I was not convinced that I had a drinking problem. Now, I could concede that my recreational use of methamphetamine had gotten a little out of hand. I don't know if you guys get the joke that's meant there. Look, I'm not here to tell you anything, but I'll tell you, for me, there's no way you can justify for me recreational methamphetamine use. I'm sorry, that just doesn't exist. It's not a thing, man. I mean, you know, for me anyway, can't be. So I was sent away for some help, and I came back home to the same home that I left. I was living alone at the time. I had gone through a divorce, and it wasn't long before I had convinced myself that my drinking was not a problem. And so instead of going to meetings like I had been encouraged to, I went to a liquor store. And, you know, I'll be damned, but my family at that little surprise party, they promised me that they were not going to sit around and watch me destroy myself any longer. They weren't going to do it. They were not going to participate. And I'll be damned. You know what? They loved me so much that they followed through with that shit. And I couldn't go to my sister's house or my mom's house. I couldn't go anywhere and drink anymore. It wasn't okay. The gig was up, man. The party was over, you know? The only place I was partying was with me and my place by myself. You know, and I can only entertain me so long, you know. And Joe said something else I really resonated with. Man, I freaking hated me. And I also thought I was the best thing going. Right?
Makes sense, though.
You know? We coined a phrase around here. Somebody said this one time I heard. And it just really stuck with me. I know you guys have heard this, but, you know, this egomaniac with an inferiority complex, right? Yeah, that just, I hate me and I'm the best thing on the planet, you know? It's crazy, but the people that I was urged back into going to AA meetings. It was kind of a condition for me to be able to participate in my family events, and so I was going, and I had this little signature card I had to get signed, and I remember that I was at an Alano Club meeting one day, and there was a girl that I thought was cute sitting the row over, and the basket came around, you know, where you put your card in the basket, and I didn't want to put my card in the basket because I didn't want her to think that I had to be there, because somehow that was different, you know? And let me just tell you, if you're here, you're here. It doesn't matter why you're here. You're here. Right. So I didn't see it that way at the time. So anyway, I'm going to these AA meetings, and I'll never forget. One day, my friend Mary is up at the podium, and she's talking about how she drank, and she's describing some of the thoughts that were going through her mind as she's drinking and how it progresses. And I was kind of thinking, you know, damn, you know, Mary and I can party, man. You know, I mean, I was relating to what she was saying. And then she started talking about some of the things that started going wrong. And I was like, oh, shit, I can relate to that too, right? But what happened for her, though, is that she found a way to quit drinking. And she started talking about this nonsense about steps and sponsors and all this. And at that point, I tuned her out, right? I was like, okay, well, she's another one of those losers, you know? And I clearly possess superior self-control. And if drinking really is a problem, can you relate? If drinking really is a problem, I'll just make up my mind and I'll stop. And that day I left that alarm club and I said, check it out, man. I'm not going to drink today. Neater, neater, neater. I'm not going to drink. I'll show you. And I got about half a mile down the road and I had this other voice kick in my head. And the other voice said, ah, come on, man. You know you're going to get loaded. I mean, why are you punishing yourself? Let's just go do it now. And then that other little angel voice on the other shoulder said,
no, no, man, don't do it. You're gonna stay sober. You're gonna live right, man. You're gonna succeed.
And I got to the place where I needed to turn to go to my house, and that other voice was talking. And I went to the liquor store. And the funny thing is, I don't know if any of you guys know him, a guy named Scott. Scott was at the freaking noon meeting I just left. And somehow he teleported to the liquor store, and it wasn't a liquor store, it was a Chevron. And I had a six pack of beer on the counter, and he's buying some gum or something, right? And I'm like, oh shit, I'm busted, man, right? And you know, I was like, fuck it. What's he gonna do? And I bought my beer and I went home. I'll show him. Come on, Scott. You know what I eventually found is that there was some truth in what I heard people at AA meetings say, and the truth was that by myself I could not stop drinking. Or if I could stop, I couldn't stay stopped. My mind would always trick me. It would come up with some perfectly rational explanation for why this time was going to be a perfectly acceptable exception to that rule, right? I can just, no, you know what, I'll just drink today, and then I'll stop again, because obviously I can't. And then I couldn't. So on Monday morning, the 11th of April of 2005, I found myself at the Alano Club out of habit. Simply out of habit. No virtue at all. I'd been going to the Alano Club for at least 4.5 months. I was 128 days sober on Friday before that Monday. And what happened is I had a minor oral procedure. And I came out of the anesthesia, and I talked the oral surgeon's nurse into giving me some narcotic pain medication. And I had to go to the pharmacy to pick up this antiseptic rinse stuff, right? And I thought, well, I'm just being efficient. There's no reason to make two trips to the pharmacy. I'll pick up the pills here, too. I'm here. Why not? And then my efficiency kicked in to high gear, and I said, hey, guess what? They've also got a case of my favorite beer here right now. And I picked that up, too. And I had taken two times the prescribed amount of the pills before I got out of the store, and I went home and I drank the case of beer. And that was how that weekend started. And then my alarm clock went off on Monday morning, and I forgot to tell my alarm clock that I had resigned from AA. And I forgot that I had resigned from AA, and I got up and I got in my car like I had been for every other day before that. I'm driving to the Alano Club, and I'm telling myself, oh, check it out, man. Nobody caught me. Nobody knows. I can carry this lie, man. You know what? I'm getting ready to get a 5-month chip. Nobody has to know about this little 2 or 3 day binge. It's no big deal. And you know, like at the dentist, when they put that heavy vest on you when they take an x-ray? I felt like I had 100 of those freaking things on me. I could hardly breathe trying to carry that line. And I walked into that Alano Club, and the first time ever, they asked me to start the meeting with the Day of Reflection. And by the time I'm done reading the Day of Reflection, I'm freaking crying in front of a bunch of strangers. And I don't know how you guys like to start your Mondays, but that is not my idea of a winning week, right? And some guy in the back of the room said, hey, man, why don't you call your sponsor? I had a guy I called sponsor. I kind of dodged him most of the time, if you want to know the truth. And I called him and I told him, I said, you might want to sit down. Because I knew he was going to be surprised and disappointed to learn that I'd been drinking again. And he wasn't even surprised at all. And it kind of hurt my feelings, if you want to know the truth. And I said, I will do anything. Okay, I told him I would do anything to stop drinking. What I meant was, I will do anything to not get in trouble anymore. That's really what I meant. But he heard what I said, and he said, well, if you're serious, then you don't have to tell me anything because your actions will tell me everything. And I said, well, okay, what do you want me to do? And he says, well, I gave you two questions to answer 128 days ago, and you've been too busy to do them. So if you want my help and if you want to stay sober, you'll get those questions done. And he asked me to do one other thing. He asked me to start journaling. He asked me to sit at least for 5 minutes every day with a pencil and paper in my hand for at least 5 minutes. And he didn't technically say I had to write anything. And there were a couple of days when all I wrote was F U Paul. His name was Paul. But I'll tell you something. Something freaking crazy happened, man. You know, the people around me started changing. and the stuff that I was writing in this journal, I mean, I was writing it, but I didn't know where it was coming from. I was like starting to see things from a different angle. And I had to talk to my sponsor about all that stuff. And he helped me. He guided me through the process. And 12 months from that day, 1 year later, I had just finished my 12-step assignment with him. And I don't know if that's the right amount of time. I hear some people do it in a weekend. Some people take longer. I don't know.
Still doing it.
I have no attitude about that for you. I'll just tell you that for me, that was an incredible, magical, amazing year. And I've continued in that process. I don't know if you heard what she said, but she said, keep doing it. And that's exactly what I've done. I still am active with my sponsor. I meet with them once a week for an hour. I also meet with the men that I sponsor, and I guide them through the steps. So I get it from both angles.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, today is 10 days, 7 months, and 16 years. And I think there should be a monument erected to that.
I missed the mic.
Right next to me. That's right. Anyway, I'm sorry. I went long, but thank you for letting me share it.
Thank you.
Not nearly enough applause.
It should be.
Is it already?
Yeah.
Oh. Should we ask for a burning desire? Is there anyone in the audience or online on our audience that maybe has something heavy on your heart? Is certainly, if you're thinking about drinking, we'd rather have you lay it on our table here. Yeah, all right.
Some terrible stuff that I'm trying to go with. And just letting things not get to me. And that's the hardest part about it. That's my biggest trigger. Letting people's crap that should take to heart and things that I should have let get to me stick there. And I just like to say I'm very thankful for my brothers in the house. I got my boy Dave right here. Anthony helps me out sometimes. Jared, you have to know all these gentlemen sitting here. I'm extremely thankful for them and their words of wisdom. Because it wasn't men like this who were there that have been through what they've been through. I'm pretty sure I would have ran out already.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to deal with a lot of stuff internally. They say when you're having issues with other people's actions, more than likely something you gotta deal with on the inside. And I'm trying to learn the trick of fill your cup, let it hit the ground, and take it away. And I just learned that one tonight. So, I guess my burning desire tonight is to steal for myself and get a lot of crap that's up there.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's about it right now.
Hey, thanks, Christian.
Thanks.
And that boy, Gabe, I've heard rumors that he made a decision recently.
Mm-hmm.
Right on, bro.
What was that?
You made a decision. I saw a certificate.
Oh, yeah. I have a desire, but it's not about wanting to drink. It's about that power, that spiritual mind of being. I'm an alcoholic.
Okay.
I worked the third step today with my sponsor, and it was awesome. It was powerful. It was deep, and it was exactly what I needed at the right moment. And we went out to lunch. It was a late lunch, and then kicked me out to the ranch, and then we go off into the middle of an almond orchard, away from everything, everybody. You know, it's just real peaceful and serene. And we finished reading for step three, and then we jump off the 12x12 at step three, And it's all about willingness. You know, it says in the book, so I know that willingness is the key. I know there's a lot of keys, but I said, you know, for that step, is willingness is the main key. You know, and listen to some gospel music, and he prayed for me, and it's exactly what I needed to hear in all aspects and corners of my life right now. You know, that power and that spiritual that divine consciousness. You know, and I texted him after this was all said and done, you know, and I even broke down and shed a couple of tears and he joined me with that, you know, it was really powerful, it really was. And I couldn't realize, you know, with when I saw him think, you know, how powerful it was and everything, he's like, man, it's not me, it's God. You know, and that right there is that's my biggest key, that's my biggest, you know, point in sobriety and recovery going forward is my spiritual connection, my higher power. You know, and I know it's not me, but I know what I do. I know what I've done. You know, it's definitely not me while I'm sitting here being sober today at all. Being able to help these guys out and come to these meetings and just do the things I get to do today, you know, step to God.
Right on, Dave.
Thank you.
Decision Dave made was called the third step, and so in the days ahead, we'll hear about his fourth step soon enough. No pressure, Dave. No pressure, babe.
Yeah. So Valley Group encourages sponsors.